everybody. It's time for another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and with me, as always, the mighty Scott Morris.
Greetings.
And the equally mighty Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Yes. Good Lord, it's been a while since we spoke to you last. Apologies for that. To make up for it, we've got a Ram Jam podcast. So without further ado, let us crack on. Scott, would you like to kick us off with a review of Tom Cruise Fest Oblivion?
I would be honoured, good sir. For the obligatory jokey intro for this, I couldn't really decide whether to go down the route of channeling the old Xbox role-playing game Oblivion or the very old Terrorvision song Oblivion from their seminal 1994 album How to Make Friends and Influence People.
Do you plan to subject them all to Oblivion?
Let's just agree that something hilarious happened here and move on to the actual plot. There's been an apocalypse.
What? No one told me. I've got letters to post.
It's inconvenient. That's just rude.
There's no forward planning from these apocalypses.
I've got lasagna in the oven.
And crisis was averted. The aliens turned tail and ran because Craig had a lasagna in the oven. We are informed by Tom Cruise's character Jack that there's been an invasion from a foe known as Scavs. Humanity has apparently won this war, although you'd be forgiven for thinking otherwise given the state of the planet, which has now been largely levelled and mostly barren. The survivors of the war have headed off-world, leaving a skeleton crew of drones and maintenance personnel in a few outposts, one of which contains Jack and Victoria, played by Andrea Riseborough. They are looking after these drones and the colossal machines that they're guarding that extract water from the oceans of Earth for apparently off-world transport to the surviving humans. They're under occasional threat from the attack of pockets of Scav survivors who were trapped on planet Earth. And so it goes for maybe half an hour or so until a craft crashes in Jack's area. When he goes to check it out, he finds human survivors cryogenically sleeping in escape pods, and he's not long on the scene before his drone buddies show up, but rather than help his rescue attempts, they start blowing the pods up. You just can't trust robots, I'm telling you. Even a little Roomba dreams of vacuuming you to death. He manages to pull rank on the drones long enough to get one of the pods back to the outpost, where he finds that it contains Julia, played by Olga Kurylenko. He finds this surprising because he's been dreaming about a woman looking very similar to her in a non-ruined Earth, and this gives him pause to reconsider some things. And it is the start of the realisation that things are not what they seem. Although if you've seen the trailer, you've got something of a head start on him. Given that it's unveiled relatively early in proceedings, it's not a deal-breaking spoiler, I suppose, but I still think it would make a better film if you didn't know most of everything that Jack is going to uncover for about two-thirds of the film from the trailer. So, out of respect for that, I am not going to promulgate that information out of a sense of loyalty to you, dear listener, and also because it gave me an opportunity to use the word promulgate.
You are a good man.
If we're not going to talk about the plot, what else can I talk about? Well, that's a bit of a struggle because there's not all that much worthy of comment in the film. It's not necessarily bad, you understand. It's just not all that interesting. Call me a curmudgeon if you must, but this whole post-apocalyptic, desert-reclaiming, ruined cityscapes visual thing has been done so often that even when it's done well, and Oblivion does it quite well, it's just not all that interesting anymore. Even in IMAX, Oblivion's nice, but it's not jaw-droppingly excellent in the kind of visual aspects of things. The more futuristic elements of the graphic design in Jack's Refuge, his runabout and his weaponry fare better, with a pleasing futuristic sheen that's reminiscent of the Mass Effect games. The drones also remind me of their non-evil counterparts from Terrorhawks, although they can't match their personality.
There's no Sergeant Major Zero.
Sadly, no.
Strong. <long. laughs>
Other than that, the performances contained within are generally more than adequate, although Morgan Freeman is here and he's tending more towards his paycheck attitude than I'd like in his relatively weak part, but it's not too obnoxious. Pop Combo M83 provide a pleasing soundscape, and it seems that director Joseph Tron Legacy Kaczynski is convinced of the value of a good soundtrack between this and the Daft Punk-laden Tron outing.
Sorry, did you say M83?
Yes.
Oh, fair enough. I only discovered them reasonably recently. That's interesting.
Yeah, it makes for a pleasing background.
It's pointless aside there. Sorry, listeners.
If you like their work, you will like this.
Cool.
And the director, he's also got a pretty good understanding of pacing and beats of the story that needs to be there. Now he just needs to find a few more interesting stories. I don't want to come across as too harsh here, you know, partly because I would like to see much more big-budget sci-fi stuff in the future, and also because Oblivion's not really a bad film. It's just one that's really a great deal more predictable than it thinks it is. The supporting elements of the story are well enough put together to stop the film collapsing, but it should really be building on top of those and not just slumping down all over them. So overall, despite not containing anything that's actually bad, it's just a little bit too close to mediocre to recommend. It has done tremendously well at the box office, so I'm heartened to see that people are taking science fiction stuff to heart, because for a while it was, you know, the odd outlier like The Matrix aside, it was basically not really given much credence as a source of, you know, mainstream film outings, and was, it looked for a while like we might only get to see big budget comic book films being made in the future, so hopefully this is going to give it a bit of a kick in the pants.
Total Recall did it cause any help, didn't have any?
Yes,
yes.
Yes.
Total Recall did such a bad job, it left me incoherent.
But why are you going to see this and you didn't go and see Dread? Audiences, I most disappoint.
Yes, I don't know. Well, if nothing else, it's given you an opportunity to both name check Roombas and also manage some terrible Terrahawks impersonations. So
that's all I ask for.
I for one shall be checking this film out. Drew,
Craig,
here comes a punch.
What a punch!
You're supposed to say thanks, Craig, and then I say you're welcome for the punch, Drew. Except substitute for the word to. Drew is going to talk to us now about Welcome to the Punch.
Yes, I am.
In 140 characters or less.
Can I just do me, just do the one character?
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. Writer and director Aaron Creevy follows up his well-regarded debut Shifty with this much larger scope filler, set in an almost futuristic-looking London. After an ambitious heist, master criminal Jacob Sternwood is almost stopped and caught by dogged young detective Max Lewinsky. He shoots, but doesn't kill Lewinsky and flees the country. 2 years later, Sternwood must come back to London after his son is involved in a shooting, and Lewinsky aims to make the most of the opportunity to apprehend his nemesis, but finds himself unexpectedly caught up in a much larger case. The cast here is strong, if for the most part typecast. Peter Mullen as a charismatic hard man. Mark Strong as a charismatic hard man. Fake Eddie Marson as a cold-eyed killer hard man. Parking Pataweo as a by-the-book junior detective. David Morrissey as a sympathetic boss cop and mentor. And Ruth Sheen as an amusingly naive gran of a cold-eyed killer hard man. And, well, frankly, I like this film just because it gave me the chance to use the words Parking Pataweo and Fake Eddie Marson in a film review.
Cool.
That isn't Eddie Marson, it is fake Eddie Marson.
Thanks for the heads up, man.
The only real wrong note here in the casting is Max Lewinsky. James McAvoy's performance is absolutely fine, but he very much feels miscast as a hard-edged, gritty cop. He just doesn't have the physical presence that the character demands. Though it must be said that his character is lacking too, and he does the best of a bad job there. Lewinsky's desire for revenge on Sternwood isn't tremendously compelling. Indeed, lack of characterization is Welcome to the Punch's biggest weakness. While Mark Strong is, as I'm sure will be a surprise to no one, the pick of the bunch, as the morally ambiguous Sternwood, most of the characters are underwritten and secondary to the plot. There are other, admittedly minor problems in addition to its sacrifice of character for plot. For instance, while it's addressed in the film, it's never adequately explained why Lewinsky is left alive at the beginning. Left not dead, but just wounded by the apparently notoriously ruthless Sternwood. And Sternwood himself changes from a man who can't shoot someone 2 feet away with a handgun to a demon with an assault rifle who would put the SAS to shame. Of course, there's some humour in here to leaven things. It's stylish, and it looks absolutely lovely. Ed Wilde's crisp photography certainly making Welcome to the Punch look much more than its £5.5 million budget. And Creevy's inspiration by the likes of Andy Lau is clear, and this refreshingly makes it a British crime film reflecting the East rather than the West. Welcome to the Punch is also a British crime thriller that isn't either a Mockney-filled Guy Ritchie joint, or the sort of steaming turd that Nick Love might produce. Though it is, alas, set in the same non-existent Daily Mail Britain of Harry Brown and Cherry Tree Lane, though fortunately considerably better than either of those. And it certainly makes me hopeful of future films from director Creevy. His undeniable sense of style, married with a more rounded script, could be quite compelling. At an end, Welcome to the Punch is a fast-paced, stylish crime flick that might leave you wanting in character development, but nonetheless worth a watch.
No, I would rather disagree with that, in as much as it's now lingering near the bottom of my big, roughly sorted by enjoyment list of films I've seen this year.
You bastard.
You're saying it's sacrificing characterization for plot, but I don't think it's really got a plot either. I mean, what puzzled me is this was a script that had been put on a number of, well, the... You're perhaps aware of the blacklist of, you know, the best unproduced film scripts knocking around America. There's a sort of roughly equivalent one for the UK, which the name which escapes me in a minute. But a couple of years back, it was quite high up on that. And so I was surprised to find that out, given how completely underwritten almost all of it is. If you look at the central plot, you know, it's, you know, two mismatched characters who have to, like, join together against a common foe. Well, really? What a revelation. Not heard that before.
I suspect it probably got on that list because it was always pitched as, it's Heat, but in London.
It's Heat, but rubbish. The whole thing's centred around uncovering this conspiracy, which, I mean, fair enough, it executes on most of the details leading up to it well enough that I'd be tempted to give it a pass, but the conspiracy's just so ridiculous and risky and completely unlikely to achieve its aims.
The conspiracy is dumb. It's very, very stupid.
And as Drew points out, the real conspiracy in this film is the existence of an Eddie Marsan cloning facility, because if you've seen Johnny Harris, he looks so similar to Eddie Marsan when he's got a beard that I'm pretty sure it was Eddie Marsan.
Yeah, and the number of films that Eddie Marsan's also in, it certainly leads one to be suspicious.
Yeah, I've never seen them in the same room.
Yeah, you never see them in the same room, yeah.
Yes.
So I just wasn't very impressed by most of this. I suppose it's largely adequate in most respects. You know, as you say, McAvoy's strong, the likeable actors, but I just think McAvoy's completely miscast. He doesn't have the physical presence, and his attitude should be for someone who's about 20 years older than he is. Now, for the sake of spoilers, you can't really talk too much about the conspiracy, which is why I really didn't like it towards the end, because it is just so dumb, and I hadn't built enough goodwill before that to let it get away with it. As you say, it's also in this, it's just set in a world that is far more violent than this world actually is, which is what it's using to base around its conspiracy.
And that's even more annoying. The fact that police officers are being killed left, right and centre, apparently. Despite the fact that almost never happens in this country.
What interests me about that is it sounds like it's a British crime film pandering to the American notion of a British crime film. And on that note, here is why I intensely dislike this film, despite having never seen it. There is no such thing, and this is why I will not go and see this film. It pissed me off. There is no such thing as a police officer working in this country who has the name Max Lewinsky. Fuck right off. That is something a 12-year-old would write in a short story they've done for their English homework because they've been watching Die Hard and a million other fucking American action films. Yeah, this guy's got Max Lewinsky. Yeah, go away, grow up, come back and talk to me in 20 years from now when you can actually write something that seems relevant to me. That's all I have to say on that.
From a distance, all I can really remember is being a kind of below-average thriller, but I remember being much more annoyed by it coming out of the cinema. But either way, I still would not recommend it. Yeah, give this one a miss.
Unrecommended. Okay, so I'm going to talk briefly now about Sightseers, which is the sophomore effort of Kill List director Ben Wheatley, and sees British comic bit part actors Alice Lowe and Steve Oram as Tina and Chris, who are a new-ish couple who embark on a caravanning trip through the Yorkshire Dales despite the protestations of Tina's overbearing mother. If that sounds like a recipe for tedium, then you're probably right, except for the fact it soon transpires that Chris has a penchant for surreptitiously murdering broadly painted British social stereotypes. And rather than recoil in horror, Tina comes round to the idea and begins bumping off a few herself. The notion of Daily Mail branded justice rubbing off on others in the most brutal sense imaginable feels alarmingly prescient to me and provides an appealing target for black satire. However, Sightseers doesn't fare so well in evoking the atmosphere I suspect it was gunning for. Whereas Kill List elicited a palpable sense of gradually building dread, Sightseers is a little more muddled and doesn't provide perhaps enough levity to balance the blacker elements of its plot. Nevertheless, it is an effective zero-budget affair that works on a number of levels and is, though not so much as Kill List, a sure sign that independent British filmmaking is in safe hands while Shane Meadows is on hiatus. Throw questions at me about Sightseers, please.
I have no questions, but I do notice that Alice Lowe played David Bowie in an episode of Stuffbox, so
she did indeed.
Gets my vote.
Yes.
I did want to see this, actually. The trailer did look really quite interesting and it seemed to vanish out of cinemas in about 3 weeks.
Yeah,
so I managed to miss it. But
it is interesting and it gained some sort of audience, as far as I understand, but watching it on catch up, you know, it's one of those where sometimes you sit down and you've been quite looking forward to something and you think, well, the best place to view this is going to be from the comfort of my sofa, which I think is a phrase I've used many times before. And I sat down there and I watched it, and by the end of it I thought, maybe I'm just in a weird mood today, because I didn't enjoy it as much as I'd anticipated I would. It certainly has a lot to offer. It's certainly infinitely more interesting than a lot of films being punted about these days. You can tell it's been made on zero budget, but then so was Kill List. And I don't want to be down on it, because Ben Wheatley is quite clearly, if not a prodigious talent, then certainly a very, very interesting, very promising talent on the British independent movie scene at the moment. But it just didn't quite strike a chord with me like Kill List did. Having said that, Kill List was one of those examples of a film where it was the reasons behind why I enjoyed it so much were quite nebulous. I can't necessarily pin them down. The only thing that I can refer to specifically is the atmosphere that it evoked. Other than that, and the sort of rawness of some of the character portrayals and stuff like that, it's quite difficult to say here is exactly why I enjoyed Kill List, because at the end of the day it wasn't a film that necessarily I think you were supposed to enjoy so much as feel some sort of, I don't know, connection with on a level beyond that which you can easily discuss or write down in a sort of three paragraph review. But yeah, Sightseers, it's like, yeah, on paper sounds great. I'd heard really good word of mouth about it. Just a little bit disappointed that sort of horror and humour can work really, really well hand in hand if they're balanced properly, and if the humour is, well, for want of a better word, funny enough to compensate for like the darkness of it. But the film goes to some pretty, pretty dark places, and there were points in it where I'm like, I know I'm supposed to be laughing at this and feeling a little bit of levity after that just happened, but it's not quite funny enough, and therefore the film takes on this tone which I think is, you know, only sort of marginally what Wheatley was gunning for. But it's certainly quite brave. It's very, very interesting. The performances are great in it. It doesn't quite pull off that balancing act, and if it had done that as well as I'd hoped, I think I'd be raving about it. But I certainly would tell anybody to go and watch it if you're in the mood for something different. If you're in the mood for mass murderers who walk about in, I don't know, like North Face jackets and have woolly jumpers on, then yeah, I can't think of too many films in that vein. So
it's quite niche.
It is quite niche. I can't imagine how well this would play outside the UK. I know sometimes these sort of like these breakout films, you know, the films can attain a certain cult status, and the locality of it and the sort of the way it's quite specific to British culture wouldn't matter so much. It'll carry internationally because it'll strike a chord with people. Regardless, I can't see that happening with this film, to be honest with you. I can't imagine it playing outside of Britain because the stereotypes are so kind of intrinsically British. The sort of the downbeat sort of characterization of most of the roles is, it's one of those films where it kind of wants to be down on everybody. It's intrinsically British in that sense, and that it's got no sense of optimism about it, you know what I mean? So I don't know how it's going to appeal to like a mass market, but check it out by all means. I'd be interested to know if anyone else has watched it, what they thought of it. I think I was only disappointed by it because of the anticipation. One of those cases where it's been built up quite a bit. But
I'm definitely need to catch up with this. Sightseers and Kill List, if nothing else, Ben Wheatley was the director of quite a lot of the episodes of Ideal, which is still, for my money, the most imaginative sitcom that's been you know, since
the year
2000.
Was that the Johnny Vegas one?
Yeah.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
I initially dismissed because it looked like, oh, it's Johnny Vegas doing fat jokes again, but it actually isn't. It's really imaginative. It continually reinvented itself and was a continually surprising sitcom. or push the limits of what you could do with that. And it was a really good experience watching that. It was really well done. Again, as you say, completely parochial. I don't think it would travel anywhere outside of, well, certainly Britain, possibly Liverpool. I will catch up with this guy's work in the next few months. Hopefully.
Yeah, please do and let us know what you think. Yes. Yeah, I don't want to be down on it because if nothing else, it is still a really good film. But most importantly, it's interesting and it's someone doing something that I haven't quite seen attempted before. So, Ben, I know you listen to this podcast on a regular basis and I know you're beholden to my opinions, but please, mate, don't let it stop you from your next project. I'll be heartbroken. Just go for it, mate. Go for it. I've got every faith in you. With which we hand over to Scott again for some words on Trance.
I suppose the first thing you need to point out with Danny Boyle's latest film, Trance, is that it is not shooting for documentarian levels of gritty realism. In fact, it rather tests the elasticity of the suspension of disbelief quite heavily.
What?
Perhaps too heavily for most people, but here, hypnotherapy might as well be called magic, and we see a welcome return of the bashed on the head equals amnesia trope that I thought had been parodied out of existence a few years back.
As long as he doesn't include bashed on head again to get back out of it.
I was going to say, please.
It does not. However, I am still hoping for a recurrence of a tramp seeing something weird, doing a double take, and then lobbing a half-filled bottle of liquor away. That's a silly place to start a review, so let's reboot this a little bit. Trance sees auctioneer Simon, played by James McAvoy, running us through his knowledge of the security protocols for removing particularly valuable paintings, or as I shall call them for the remainder of the review, MacGuffins, from the premises in case of a robbery. These details would prove incredibly useful for Frank, played by Vincent Cassell, what with him and his gang about to rob Simon's auction house and all. As part of the heist, Simon takes a bash to the head, and as mentioned earlier, Frank gets away with the bag of art, except it turns out to be a bag of empty, as it seems that Simon's managed to pull a rope-a-dope. The old switcheroo, the Cincinnati hot dog, the Cuban sandwich, the Earl Grey bergamot experience. I love making up fake names for cons. It's one of my favourite pastimes. Anyway, Frank's none too pleased, and he visits Simon to find out the location of their beloved MacGuffin, which it soon becomes apparent Simon had been helping Frank scan steel. Sadly, the knock to the noggin has surgically removed Simon's memory of where he stashed the painting.
That's convenient.
Oh no!
After torture doesn't jog his memory, a somewhat desperate Frank points Simon in the direction of Elizabeth, played by Rosario Dawson's hypnotherapy studio.
What were they hoping from torture? I've lost my memory. Get electrodes on that man's balls.
Of course, the initial thought was that he's just trying to double cross us and he's just holding out where he stashed it and doesn't want to tell us. They thought he was pretending rather than actually not remembering.
Sorry, mate, my bad.
Sorry. Sorry about pulling those fingernails out. They'll grow back.
I thought hammering wood nails into your testicles would help, but sorry, I should have researched your medical background more. Let's grab a pint.
I should have done more peer review. Anyway, so he is taken to Elizabeth's hypnotherapy studio in hopes on blocking Simon's mind tubes like a mind plumber with a mind plunger. Now, Trance is the sort of film where knowing a great deal about the film before going into it can only be to your detriment. So again, I am going to bitch out on recapping the plot by saying that it's for your own good. I won't go into any more depth on the plot, apart from what I've already said, which ought to be familiar to anyone who's seen the trailer. One other aspect of the trailer that's brought up, and it forms the basis of the ongoing and increasing mind screw of the film, is that Simon soon no longer knows who to trust, and having a paranoid, possibly delusional, loose cannon in the middle of your heist plan isn't a good situation for anyone to be in. Now, I quite enjoy Trance, but you do have to give it some leeway. In particular, Elizabeth's hypnotherapy is able to do whatever the plot demands of it, no matter how unlikely, which is quite convenient. The final reveal of what, by the end, had become a likeably convoluted mess is the sort of thing that less competently made films would have had me snorting in derision at. I refer the honourable audience to Welcome to the Punch. However, Trance is more than competently made, as you'd probably expect from Danny Boyle. It's slick and it's stylish, and it does a reasonable job of doling out developments and twists at a pacing to maintain interest. It doesn't have quite the punch you might have been expecting, though, especially in the final reels, where it really feels as though it should be picking up the pace, and instead it's content to just mosey along at a comfortable stroll. It's never dull, but it does feel overly restrained for its own good. The leads all perform well in their roles, especially as things really unfold and unravel towards the end, although there's no standout brilliant turn amongst them. And to be honest, you can apply that general precept to everything in the movie. It's all good without being excellent, which is a little frustrating, to be honest. While Trance is still one of the more enjoyable and well-put-together films of 2013 so far, it just feels as though it has the potential to hang together just a little better and be really great rather than really good. But perhaps I'm looking a gift horse in the mouth a little bit too closely. Really good is good enough for me. It's just a little bit disappointing. I was expecting to be absolutely blown away by it, and I'm just sort of quite impressed. So it gets a recommendation. It's certainly one of the better films that we'll talk about this podcast. It just seemed like it had all the elements to really come together and become something fabulous, and it just winds up being just, rather than being more than the sum of its parts, it's just the sum of its parts, which thankfully is more than good enough, but I was just hoping it would be just that little bit extra to, you know, kick things off and really ignite the DNT. It's good, certainly enjoyed it, and certainly recommend it to anyone, but just wish it had been just that little bit better, you know?
What interests me about Trance is that I've listened to a number of different interviews and read a few interviews with Danny Boyle about it, where a lot of interest seems to have been expressed in the fact that he's been quite open, or not necessarily open, but he sort of implied, look, you know, I made this film kind of while we were in the midst of doing like the Olympic stuff and that. Just don't take it too seriously. I was kind of just fucking around. And part of me thinks, like, no, that's cool. Thanks for giving me the context of that. I know not to expect a huge amount from it. But another part of me thinks, right, this film still had a budget that would have provided third world countries with untold quantities of rice. And untold quantities of rice and inoculations and mosquito nets. So if you are going to do it, kind of devote your full attention to it. Don't sort of gaily tell me that I was just kind of joshing with this one. Of course, I'm paraphrasing greatly there, but I'm not. At first I thought, nah, that's quite cool, you know, the rest of it, yeah. The more I think about it, the more I think, I don't know if I'm happy about that. I mean, what budget was this film playing with?
Trance's budget was £13 million.
£13 million, okay. So, you know, in terms of British filmmaking, sort of a pretty reasonable budget. I mean, it's still less than half what he was working on Sunshine with, I suppose, but I don't imagine he was spending quite so much on effects and stuff this time round.
No, I would have thought not. There's no one very obvious CG part that was in one of the trailers, or at least the web promos for it, which you may have seen, is half of Vincent Cassell's head continues a monologue with someone after being shot.
I haven't seen that. Because everyone said, oh, there's plot points in this, and sort of all the reviews I've heard have said, look, you know, don't let anyone tell you any spoilers. I've kind of avoided hearing anything about it because I wanted to catch up with it. But now I'm fascinated. Let me just intricately craft a transition into the next film. Boz. Drew, tell us about Compliance.
From the mid-1990s until the mid-2000s, a number of incidents occurred across the United States of a man phoning businesses, most commonly fast food restaurants, claiming to be a police officer and enlisting the help of managers at the businesses to detain employees or customers and subject them to detention, humiliation, and often worse. These continued until one incident in 2004 finally led to an arrest, and it's this final incident that Compliance tells a true story of. Now, around here, we, quite rightly, scoff at films that purport to be based on a true story. Typically, it's a claim that has as much substance as a politician's promise. But in the case of Compliance, it's actually rather important. But I'll come back to that.
Drew, what if the politician in question is Nigel Farage?
He doesn't make promises, he only makes threats.
Sorry, there was a UKIP party political broadcast on the television earlier, which was just dangerously close to a Daily Mail front page. Sorry, sir, carry on.
I'm not quite sure why UKIP aren't just sponsored by the Daily Mail and the Daily Express, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So fast food restaurant manager Sandra receives a phone call from a man claiming to be a police officer, saying that a woman has accused one of Sandra's staff of stealing from her handbag. He asks Sandra to detain this employee, Becky, and then gradually ramps up his demands from having Sandra search Becky's belongings to strip searching her and then beyond, all done over the phone. This man gradually drip feeds information to Sandra about this being part of a bigger investigation, and uses this prepared backstory, along with names and facts picked up during the telephone conversation, along with massaging of Sandra's ego with praise about how helpful she is being and how much he feels he can trust her, to keep escalating things and to deflect her suspicions and questions. This means that an innocent young woman is kept prisoner in her own place of work by people she knows for hours and hours, as increasingly degrading and humiliating behaviours perpetrated towards her. There are some strong performances here from a relatively little-known cast, with particular credit going to Anne Dowd as the vain, easily manipulated manager Sandra, and some credit too to Dreamer Walker as Becky, as she becomes an increasingly vacant and shut-off person as her plight mounts. The documentary-style camera work and claustrophobic setting of the restaurant's back rooms adds to the atmosphere of Becky being trapped. Indeed, there's very little wrong with it either technically or in terms of performance. But the story is so incredibly ludicrous that it all seems for naught. So now let me come back to this based on a true story claim of compliance. It's important to know that it has some basis in reality before you watch it because, from the very beginning, what the characters are doing to one another seems infeasible and far-fetched. But with the knowledge that humans do some very odd things, compliance's truthful inspiration will let you stick with it up to a point. Certainly, I was with it through the detention of Becky by her manager, and I was probably prepared, just, to accept her being strip-searched by the stupid woman who was blindly following a voice of perceived authority in a telephone. Becky stripping down to prove she hadn't secreted any stolen money and clear things up makes a little, a very little sense. But beyond this point, it just went too far. Light years too far. I was screaming at the film, now utterly perplexed as to how the audience could be expected to believe the behaviour of any of the characters. Why these people would do these things to a fellow human, let alone a colleague and friend. I question why none of the increasingly bizarre and inappropriate demands of the fake police officer raised any alarms. Why nobody thought to make any checks. And I couldn't understand why the victim didn't do anything, didn't protest more about her treatment. And in the end, I thought compliance an interesting premise, but ultimately spoiled by taking things too far. And then, after the film ended, I did a little research. And the chilling truth is that almost all of the things, including the very worst experiences Becky is subjected to, that happened in the film, actually happened in the 2004 incident I mentioned earlier. Which is why you should probably consider watching Compliance. Rather than a far-fetched thriller, it's an almost documentarian look at the shocking things human beings will do to one another. Not in times of great stress, not in war, not because of sociopaths, but regular people on a regular afternoon, in a regular place, because some voice on a phone said so. Which is the most frightening thing of all. So I suggest, bearing that in mind, you'd consider giving it a watch. Just if you do so, just expect to be vein-throbbingly, mouth-frothingly angry while doing so.
Son of a bitch.
I looked it up beforehand. I knew this was true way into it, but it just doesn't feel believable.
Yeah,
and which I think is more of a fault with reality than with me, I think.
Exactly. I knew roughly it was based on a true story that...
I think maybe it's embellishing it a little bit. It's maybe gilding the lily somewhat, but if anything, it's being quite restrained in what it does, shows.
It really ramps up towards the end, and some of the things that are happening, some of the things this fake police officer is saying, I genuinely, I'm screaming at the television thing. Why would anybody do that? Why aren't you asking a question? Why are you telling this guy to fuck off?
I'm sure we've all joked about that you could probably get away with anything if you just carry a clipboard and look authoritative and command people around. It's that similar kind of idea.
It's bewildering is what it is.
Yeah, people just, someone told me to do this, therefore it's all right. It's the basis of which most modern warfare is carried around.
Yeah, we're just conditioned, yeah.
Yeah, it is by no means an enjoyable watch. I don't think it's that's really the target of it, but it's definitely worth looking at and to get you thinking about sort of the psychology of everyday situations. And you know, just because someone in supposed authority tells you to do something that is completely against any normal person's morals, you might just go along with it because you've been told to do so by someone with authority.
Probably an uncomfortable watch in the sense that it highlights some painful truths about the human condition.
Yes.
Yes.
I just want to reiterate, though, if you do watch this, I'd say it's worth doing so. No matter how far-fetched you think the thing is, how ridiculous and unbelievable it is, I assure you it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's anything in that film that doesn't seem to have actually happened in the real case.
Yeah.
Madness.
Scary.
I also like the filmmaker's devotion to coming across like a documentary by having the opening sequence basically just being lots of slightly out of focus shots of various mundane bits of background scenery and stuff, which is your standard stock B-roll footage of every documentary ever, so that worked out quite well.
Eat.
Because there was another scene that I was a little bit confused by why they were showing it. It was showing the policeman driving from the police station to the fast food restaurant where this was all based. Right, and I thought, why are they showing me this? Because it was just like 2 minutes or so of someone driving a car. Then, of course, it hits you as it points out a bit later on that the whole point of this was it's all predicated around a police officer not being able to get from the station or wherever he's saying he's coming from to the restaurant to pick us up. And it's half a mile down the road.
Basically, yes. Yeah. Block away.
Yeah. This is definitely worth watching. It is not the sort of thing that I could watch and say, well, if you're looking for a nice way to spend the night, then watch this, because it's quite uncomfortable to watch in a great many places, but it's certainly worth a look.
Yeah, too often we say worthy but dull. This is worthy but harrowing, but certainly worthwhile.
I've just realised, actually, let me throw it in quickly here, that I had the niggling suspicion at the back of my mind that I had actually caught up with something else on demand, and I am right. I've just realised that I also watched Barry Levinson's The Bay, so let me chuck that in there. He may have been under the radar for a while lately, but Barry Levinson, you will remember from such films as Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, Disclosure, Sleepers, Wag the Dog, Sphere, etc., etc., etc. Just quickly, basically, a synopsis of The Bay is that it's relies on the now increasingly annoying found footage trope. But in this case, it starts out documenting an environmental disaster that happens in this coastal Maryland town, which soon develops into something far more sinister. What I will say for it is this. It is as interesting an example of the found footage meme as I have come across. It's not as entertaining as something as Cloverfield, but it does pitch itself bizarrely somewhere between something like Contagion and Cloverfield, and it wants to sort of base itself in some kind of medical and environmental fact, but it maybe stretches itself a little bit too far when it comes to the sort of gross out elements and the way that this biological contamination manifests itself. But if you are a fan of such things, which I am not, but if you are a fan of such things, then it is probably worth checking out, because it is at least vaguely interesting, competently produced, and certainly is based in something a lot more sensible than the Blair Witch Project, and that is all I have to say about that. After which, I believe it is time now for Scott to fill us in the house, or in the hizzy, as I believe the parlance of our time dictates.
Yes, this Ali G vehicle, this is, of course, Francois Ozon's latest film, finds us joining a middle-aged, grumpy, disillusioned high school literature teacher, Mr. Germain, played by Fabrice Luchini. While I assume that a good part of his attitude is just part of the natural condition of being French, another part comes from years of seeing students pass through his class without kindling a great deal of love for the written word. It does seem that he may have finally found someone with a talent for writing when Claude, played by Ernst Umhauer, appears on the scene, albeit a kinda creepy talent that seems unhealthily focused on middle-aged women. Germain resolves to take Claude under his wing and try to guide and foster his talent, which Claude takes in a rather peculiar direction. Having seemingly at random picked one of his classmates and his family as the subject of a series of essays, he befriends Rafa, Bastien Ogueto, under the guise of helping him with his maths homework, and gradually insinuates him into the lives of these strangers. Now, the extent of her knowledge of what goes on in the family home comes from Germain and Claude, or occasionally Germain and his art gallery managing wife, Jean, played by Kirsten Scott Thomas, reviewing Claude's essays, and the exact truths of what goes on as various small domestic niggles in Rafa's household grows and spills into Germain's life, it's always something of a question mark. The style of Claude's writing of the essays changes as times pass, and so then does her view of Rafa's experiences, as the actors sort of portray the experiences that as written by the essay rather than what would actually happen in reality. And so it goes until these increasingly edgy essays and the experiences they're based on just blow up in everyone's faces in ways that seemed reasonable in the context of the film, although somewhat daft given some distance from it. Now, my thoughts on leaving this film were, well, firstly that I really, really liked it, but perhaps more strongly that In the House is a very clever film, which can be a bit of a double-edged sword, as films that take this much price in fairly subtle twisting of your perceptions with the different narrative stances could easily come across as smug, or at least admirable, but not enjoyable or likeable. But thankfully that's not the case within the house, in large part due to the charismatic ensemble cast who bring out some real depth to the roles. The bit part joke characters aside, the main cast slash essay subjects feel like rounded and complete characters that it's easy to empathise with. Even the creepy 16-year-old who's deceiving half of them to write stories for a half-burnt-out old teacher. It's a terrifically engaging film that kept my interest from start to finish, and its approach to storytelling is, if not completely unique, at least highly unusual and very enjoyable. Indeed, the only bone I've got to pick with the film could probably kind of be explained away as an aspect of the clever necessity of the film, which is a perfectly cromulent word. It seems to struggle to find a voice for the ending, but even that's mirrored in the narrative struggles that Claude's having, trying to reach some sort of conclusion, so there's some sort of that kind of coming to play in the final reels. That said, even if it's got a good excuse, it's still a somewhat messy ending as various things come to a head, seemingly only because we're reaching the end of the film rather than due to any particular organic reason. That, however, is a bit of a nitpick in a film that I otherwise enjoyed heartily, so much so that it shoots straight into number two position in my draft and somewhat sadly underpopulated list of films I've seen this year, second only to Lincoln so far. In exactly the same way that you're compelled to kneel before Zod, you should watch this film.
All right.
Yes, but I enjoyed it immensely, so I don't have much to add to Scott. The only thing watching it, one thing distracting was the fact that the kid playing Claude looks remarkably like a 16-year-old Christopher Eccleston, which distracted me an awful lot. But he does look remarkably like him, do you know what I think, Scott?
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
The other thing is, it's a film that, well, first of all, it's an intellectually made film, which is refreshing to see because they're so disappointingly rare. The only other potential pitfall the film has, unfortunately it doesn't fall into, is that a film so much of whose plot is based on storytelling and literary structure better be bloody good at it itself, and fortunately it is much better than me right now because I can't think of the hell to finish that sentence. It does struggle a bit with the ending. It doesn't quite pull off what it suggests it might when the teacher tells Claude that the best way to do an ending is to have one that nobody saw coming, but that any other ending would be impossible. I wouldn't say it managed that.
No.
But it is, I would struggle to see how you would bring that satisfactory to the end of a film like that, actually. But it's smart, it's really entertaining, the characters are fantastically engaging, it's very, very interesting. I spent the entire film so really, really curious to find out quite what was going to happen next. It really had me hooked from the beginning. Excellent, smart filmmaking. Watch it.
Do as you are told. Obey. Interesting that that follows a review of Compliance, and now you're telling people to watch it, Drew. Who the hell do you think you are? Smash the system!
You're a rightful king.
Fair enough.
Kneel before Drew's odd.
Right, time for another Craig Info Blast. McCullen is an interesting enough documentary by David and Jackie Morris that gives an overview and some insight into the work of photographer Don McCullen, primarily through interview with the man himself. Known primarily for his work in war zones throughout the 60s, 70s and 80s, McCullen was something of a figurehead for British photojournalism throughout those eras, though in later years he has experimented more with portraiture and landscape. The reason for this is that Don eventually decided he'd had quite enough of man's inhumanity to man, and throughout the documentary there are plenty of examples of his war work that will make it painfully obvious why he would choose to dedicate more time to natural beauty than unbridled bloodlust. McCullen is not the world of photography's most engaging speaker, though his measured, thoughtful meditation on his time in the field is by no means boring. But as you would expect, the doc is definitely at its most powerful when the pictures are doing the talking. If you've seen the arguably superior documentary War Photographer about the work of James Nachtwey, then you'll probably feel as though you're doubling up on a lot of material here. There is still enough insight, however, to make it worthwhile for fans of the art form, and indeed is as good an opportunity as any to take in a broadly representative sample of Don's work. McCullen does, crucially, have one key advantage over War Photographer, and that is it does not feature input from the uber-annoying Christiane Amanpour. So it's almost worth when you put it that way, almost any film that does not feature Christiane Amanpour, I would recommend checking out. We all have a vested interest in photography, the three of us.
Indeed.
Have either of you watched War Photographer?
No, I got hold of a new recommendation many moons ago.
Is it in your incredibly small pile of films that you have not watched yet?
My incredibly small pile of films, which numbers in the high hundreds at the very least. That small pile, yes.
You know what, I've seen War Photographer, but I honestly couldn't tell you anything that happened, Bill. any of the sort of details of the film.
I couldn't believe the twist.
Yeah.
He's a ghost!
I remember, I remember seeing like some of the harrowing photographs from it, but I can't remember any of the documentary around it. So
there's a problem with these sorts of things, that it's a sort of well-worn path to go, yes, we all kind of know war is bad, and war photography, or a lot of people don't like to refer to it as that anymore, sort of photojournalism relating to war, is something that has been front and centre pretty much since 2001 in the sort of public conscience. We've faced a deluge of it, more so than in previous decades, because now, of course, we have the internet to spread things. And so I feel like these documentaries are somewhat out of time, in that we kind of already know everything that the documentary wants to tell us, and they live or die, I think, on the magnetism or the enigmatic sort of presence of the photographers on whom they're centred. And James Nachtwey, again, not like the most enigmatic guy in the world. If you want to hear a photographer talk interestingly, sorry, my expanded vocabulary has left me at the hands of too much vodka tonight. If you want to hear a photographer talk eloquently and engagingly, then I have always loved to listen to Joel Meyerowitz. He's a guy who offers insight into his work rather than just some basic message about the medium itself. Whereas both War Photographer and McCullen suffer from a degree, I think, of sort of over-treading the path of, oh, war is bad, and, oh dear, these guys, they put themselves in harm's way and subject themselves to so much to bring us the truth of war. And in that sense, war photography has become sort of a casualty of the internet age, in that we are all just seconds away and one mouse click away from being able to see it from any number of sources. The professional photographer no longer is king of the battlefield, as any number of images and films from the likes of Syria recently, to pick an example, will prove. There are any number. Anyone with a phone in their pocket in the midst of one of these conflicts is a photographer now, a war photographer, and they have the context of actually being part of the society being torn apart by that war, as opposed to some sort of middle-class white guy with a camera who is taking sort of the middle-age equivalent of a gap year to go and do something serious like document. I almost feel sorry that we don't necessarily need the war photographer anymore, but I don't know what that says about our society, that there's no more powerful statement they can give us than we've seen already from any other number of sources. So yeah, it very much depends on the nature of the photographer themselves, and perhaps the insight we get into them rather than the nature of war or, you know, the art of photography itself. War Photographer with James Nachtwey covered quite a few bases in terms of like the technicality of photography, in so much as we saw a lot of what happens inside the sort of printing process and the sort of gallery images that are produced. But McCullen, while it's quite an interesting documentary, unfortunately, perhaps there's not enough focus on the man himself. And while his body of work still remains really almost as powerful a body as there is out there, I didn't find him as engaging a presence as I would like. And therefore, I don't think this would be my first stop if you only had time to digest one film on the subject. However, if it is your bag and it's photography, or specifically sort of photography on the or in the theatre of conflict, is something you're interested in, then it is certainly worth recommending. I notice it's been nominated for a couple of BAFTAs this year. It was nominated for a couple of BAFTAs this year. I'm not sure I would say it was that good, but maybe perhaps that's just, I feel like we've been spoiled by like a raft of really good documentaries in the past few years. It's one of those fields that really seems to have come into its own recently, and perhaps just judging it against the sort of the cream of the crop and that, yeah, it's not a shiny example, but certainly if you're interested in the medium or the topic, then it is worth checking out. Seamlessly on which note, Scott is now going to talk about Identity Thief.
In Identity Thief, Jason Bateman's Sandy is a mild-mannered middle manager by day, but at night transforms into a mild-mannered loving family man. All in all, a thoroughly nice guy, and one truly undeserving of having his identity stolen by Melissa McCarthy's malicious Miami masquerading malcontent Diana, who goes on to empty Sandy's bank account and credit cards. What a rotter.
Boo.
This couldn't come as a worse time, as Sandy's in the middle of changing jobs, and the catastrophic black hole his credit rating has now entered threatens his career, and the local police are sympathetic but explain that they can only investigate offences committed in Sandy's native Denver and can't advise their Miami colleagues to look into this matter for presumably very good reasons that we don't need to worry about right now.
Convenient plot reasons.
Yeah. This, despite knowing where Miami is going to be via a conveniently efficient and resourceful beauty parlour receptionist, finding out and calling Sandy to confirm fake Sandy Diana's appointment. A desperate plan is hatched as Sandy decides to head south with the last of his money, apprehend Diana and drag her back to Denver, whereupon she can be arrested, Sandy's name can be cleared and his life can return to normal. Simple or not so simple, as while finding Diana isn't hard, holding on to her is, thanks to her proficiency in throat punching. As you would expect from a comedy, things start snowballing in ridiculous fashion in short order, especially when Robert Patrick's bail bond jumper bounty hunter and a gang boss's two enforcers also wind up on the hunt for Diana for reasons that again are largely glossed over. However, these serve as obstacles for our protagonists to overcome while bringing them to a better understanding and respect for each other in a manner that few people could have predicted. If all of this sounds like an excuse for a loosely plotted road trip with an arbitrary zany situations, well, you're not wrong. However, no one's watching this for kind of film for story or character development, so let's not focus too heavily on how generic those aspects are in this film, although they are. Like all comedies, the only remotely relevant criteria for judging this is how funny it is. So, how funny is it? It is adequately funny. Oh, you want more detail then? Well, the genericism of the plot and its characters for the most part run through the situations that Bateman and McCarthy find themselves in, and by themselves aren't all that inherently amusing. Its saving grace is that the situations are populated by Bateman and McCarthy, and McCarthy's gift for improvisation and Bateman's underrated talent as a straight man means that they salvage a lot of the scenes quite handily. Now, I wouldn't be recommending that anyone immediately stop what they're doing and rush out and see this, but I've seen far worse comedies that have amused me less and not felt as though I needed to bring action under the description of good acts. So I'd be content to give this a mild recommendation to anyone from the market for an undemanding comedy. However, until I sat down to cobble these notes together, I paid no attention to two things, critical reception and the box office. The former is torrentially negative, and the latter is Scrooge McDuck coin-filled swimming pool positive. Now, for once, I would actually go with the box office being a better bellwether of your likely enjoyment of this film. Sense of humour is a particularly difficult thing to judge, especially when you've only got your own twisted personality to go by, and given the amount of cash this has raked in and the decent word of mouth that's happened amongst the common people, if you will, it seems to be in tune with a broad enough range of twisted personalities that statistics tell you that you will probably enjoy it. So, who are you going to trust? Cynical bastard critics like me, or the uncontestable might of statistics? That is for you to decide.
I like Clive.
Clive's a cat.
Not that Clive, just Clive.
Well, all Clives, fair enough. I'd worry if your cat was telling you what comedies to go and watch.
My cat tells me all sorts of things. You got a problem with that?
No.
It's just vodka you've been drinking.
Dear me, all of which shenaniganarianism, which is a real word, look
it's
it
perfectly
up.
Cromulent.
Yeah. Leads us to Jiro Dreams of Sushi, another documentary, on a bit of a documentary tip, about some dude called Jiro what cooks sushi, I suppose cooks is the wrong word, what plates up sushi in Japan and that. Drew, perhaps you would like to expand on my wantonly unbothered introduction.
That seems quite succinct to me.
I'm not sure what else you would add to that. Yeah, it's a documentary about a man who
is 170 years old or thereabouts.
He is in his mid-80s, isn't he? Something like 84, 85.
Something like that, yeah.
A man who is dedicated 70 years to cooking sushi. Now, let's disregard that most of the world would go, why the hell would you do that? And just accept that he's done it.
A lot of free time.
If you're going to dedicate 70 years of your life to making good food, why the hell would you choose sushi? But it is a portrait of his incredible dedication, perfectionism, and his striving to get better at his chosen profession.
Mm.
In which way, it's a bit like a film we talked about recently, Indie Game the Movie, which the fact is about indie games wasn't so relevant as in the way that this isn't really relevant. It's about sushi. It's more about one man of incredible skill and dedication trying to improve all the time and where that's taken his life. Is that sufficiently expansive in what you started with?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Let me start out by saying I, for one, was quite fascinated by this, and I hate fish. Right. I can't palate the stomach, the taste of fish on my palate. It would make me ill. And yet, so beautifully shot is the dead fish in this film that throughout I couldn't help but sit there and think, ooh, I'd like a bit of that. Now,
the only fish I can be bothered with is tuna, and the tuna did look incredibly lovely in that, but the rest of
I like a bit of tuna, as long as it comes from a can.
I do know where you're coming from, though. I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, I know if I ate that, it would literally kill me, but it doesn't taste any.
But by Jove, I would like to try. The problem I have with it is that I feel like Jiro's sort of dedication to this thing, it's almost, I feel, now of course I'm no authority, but and I know fish can be sourced in any number of ways, and I'm sure that there are elements to the preparation, but when you see that this guy like makes people work in his kitchen for like 5 years at a time doing one task, and that task might just be, like one guy has spent, what is it, 10 years or something? Like 5 to 10 years just massaging squid?
The whole apprenticeship for everybody's 10 years, but you've got to, the apprentices are on the one thing for ages. There's one man who's making egg sushi.
Yeah.
And he makes it, did he say something like 600 times he made before he got it right?
Something like that, yeah.
Which suggests to me either they're stupidly demanding or he's shit. Either way, I think most sensible people would have given up before 600.
Yeah, I think more on the overly demanding side, because to me there's an element of this thing, and to remove myself from the documentary but to take the topic, I can't help but feel there's a little element of the Emperor's clothes here. Mm. What was the analogy I was going to use? Yeah. Okay, so recently I'm reading through articles on, at a tangent here, Stradivarius violins, which are held in massive esteem and which have all sorts of stories circulating about time of year at which the wood was harvested and blah, 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 blah. You know, the wood was only taken in autumn because the quality of the wood is so different in autumn and blah, blah, blah. And any number of professional violinists saying nothing sounds at all like a Stradivarius. And then actually quite recently, a completely double-blind test was carried out on violins where a large cross-section of both professionals and amateurs were asked to play a variety of violins that couldn't be identified. They were blindfolded. They were in rooms which were, I think, lit specifically so that no detail could be made out. And without exception, the Stradivarius violins were rated the lowest or amongst the lowest in terms of tonal quality and ease of play. And I can't help but feel, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, replace the Stradivarius with sushi. I can't.
£8,000 audio interconnects.
Yeah, exactly. I can't help but feel there's an element of this guy's a legend because everybody says he is, rather than there being, it's like, okay, he might have dedicated, I could dedicate 70 years of my life to mopping a floor and tell you that there's a certain technique I use where a certain flick of my wrist gives me a cleaner finish to the floor than anything else. Why, where does this come from? Because I wanted to actually say nice things about Jiro, and now that I'm talking about it, I find myself being wound up about it. I enjoyed it. I just found the subject matter slightly annoying in that, come on, it's being embellished ever so slightly.
I appreciated his dedication.
Yes.
And things like that, but I was just, I sort of hinted off, also said it right earlier. It's the fact that, well, it's sushi.
Mm.
If you do, you know, like really high cuisine, sometimes stuff that's in high cuisine, it looks disgusting, possibly tastes disgusting, but and it's a lot more complex, and you can see how like, quality ingredients will make a real difference to the taste and the preparation. And you've got so many elements there you can really change with it. You've got a bit of rice and a bit of fish with some soy sauce on it. I don't see where the great skill is.
The quality of the fish is dependent upon the source of the fish. It's nothing to do with his preparation. And you can show me them sort of practicing slicing fish, and I can entirely believe that there is a perfect way to slice that piece of fish. However, that cannot possibly have any bearing on the flavour of the fish. So you can make that man spend 3 years learning just how to slice a piece of fish just so. It will not improve the taste, Jiro. I don't care what you say.
What got to me, and I can't really comment on how good the sushi is because I wouldn't really have a frame of reference for it because I don't like raw fish very much, but it does seem to be quite widely held as being the best place to eat sushi.
This is what puzzles me. He's like the only sushi chef that has a Michelin star, right?
Yes, at least when this was produced. I don't think it's changed since then. Whether or not I think this makes a difference, apparently in to the people that this would make a difference to and are capable of detecting it, it does. Nothing that he does in terms of like sourcing his ingredients or anything like that is particularly outlandish. It's just, it's not because he is a supernaturally skilled sushi person. It's just because he spent an awful lot of time doing this sort of thing. And that's kind of what makes it sort of slightly depressing and for me, because it's the sort of thing where you realise that if you particularly cared about doing any one thing well enough, like, say, reviewing films, if you'd dedicated enough time to actually doing it rather than, say, playing Star Wars Knights with the Old Republic, you'd actually get really good at it if you just spent enough time doing it rather than not doing it, which is what I've been doing. That's the slightly down tone I took from it. On the positive side, it's just nice to see someone who's spent so long deciding that this is going to be my job, so I'm going to do it to the best of my possible ability, and pursuing that with a single-minded ideal, which is pleasing to see given the general amount of half-arsedness I tend to put into most of my effort. Like, yes, that's good enough.
But then at the same time, it's like, yeah, I totally appreciate it. And part of me is in awe of the guy because he has dedicated 70 years to reaching the what people consider to be the pinnacle of his particular trade. But, you know, he's getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. He's going home at 11 o'clock at night.
Not seen his kids, though.
He's not seen his kids, even though his sons work for him. I can't imagine he's spent much time at the ball game with his kids. But the other part of me thinks, yeah, if it takes you 70 years to reach that place, regardless of how successful you are, you've kind of not had a life, and therefore it's all rendered redundant. So perhaps you should just fucking do something else.
That's a very harsh opinion to have of an elderly Japanese gentleman.
No, I haven't.
Admittedly, if I didn't actually go there, I don't think you could eat anything of them just like standing over you, arms crossed, staring at you, going, go on, enjoy it. Yeah. Enjoy this, Japan. Exactly. But in Japanese, obviously.
Don't you dare turn your nose up. I have nothing but total respect for the guy, except in the part where I just said I don't have total respect for the guy. Part of me, it's one of those where I'm like, flip a coin. It's either awesome or it's fucking sad. Jiro dreams of sushi. Jiro, dream of getting laid, mate.
Well, Jiro. I guess he did. That's how he's got sons.
But yeah, he's going to dedicate the next 70 years of his life to becoming a porn star. What? Get real. Shut up, Jiro. What would be great is if he suddenly became unemployed and the documentary was about Jiro collecting his gyro. Okay, I didn't quite get the reaction, I hope.
Not gales of laughter, Greg,
when your witticism elicits a from Drew, you match the waveform of my with yours, and that is...
I just don't think too many people call it a gyro anymore, which is probably why the reference would go unsullied.
Well, in my part of the world down here, it's called jidda.
What?
Oh, fucking hell, lad, where's me jidda?
Is that Welsh?
All of which has a great deal to do with sushi. Yeah, I feel bad now because I feel like I came on here to be positive about Jiro and all I've done is be down on it. I still found it quite a fascinating documentary, if only because my amazement at both this guy's excellence but also the utter pointlessness of his existence rendered me in some sort of trance while I was watching it. Maybe that's just me.
And I was kind of disappointed that I didn't even question about why his kitchen's an entire sausage fest. Women very much conspicuous by their absence there.
Sorry, I had no idea what you were talking about there until you clarified that.
I've never heard that expression before, sausage fest.
No, I can't. Maybe I have in the midst of time, but sausage fest. Why is your kitchen a sausage fest? I'm confused. I cook sushi. My restaurant stocks only fish, rice, and eggs. Jiro dreams of sausage. Yeah, thanks for bearing with us while we cut through that particular mire of movies. Apologies for the delay. We promise we won't be so late in getting back in touch with you next time. Remember that in the meantime, if you have any questions, queries, or feedback, please feel free to get in touch with us. The email address is podcast@theoneliner.com. You can find us on Twitter @TheOneLiner. We are easy enough to track down individually on Twitter if you should so desire. And if you can, please spare 5 seconds out of your life, pop on iTunes, rate the podcast. You'll be doing us a huge favour, and we promise that we will make endless love to you in the next life. I had my fingers crossed behind my back there. I have been Craig, as always, Scott was Scott.
Inverse greetings.
And Drew was indubitably Drew.
Fairly well.
Is it true that you only stole a loaf of bread? No. I'm critically disappointed that I only stole a loaf of bread hasn't become an internet meme. I truly thought it would. Yeah, fare thee well. Go and do something useful with your lives. Bye. However, I will gladly chew the crumbs from this packet of cream crackers like some sort of heroin addict using his oily fingers to scrape the remnants from his cooked spoon.